From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. The 2016 election left everyone concerned about the environment, fearful that progress on climate change would come to a screeching halt. And for all intents and purposes, this administration is doing everything possible to make that a reality.
But Michael Bloomberg and Carl Pope are trying to do something about that. Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, and Pope, the former executive director and chairman of the Sierra Club, approached climate change from different perspectives, yet they arrived at similar conclusions.
That's right. Without agreeing on every point, they share a belief that cities, businesses, and citizens can lead and win the battle against climate change, no matter which way the political winds in Washington may blow.
They've joined forces to co-author a new book titled Climate of Hope. The book offers optimistic solutions and practical steps they believe are necessary to slow climate change. Carl Pope joins us in the first part of the show to discuss his book, Climate of Hope, How Cities, Businesses, and Citizens Can Save the Planet.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll talk with Dan Hardinger of the Wilderness Society about the president's recent executive order, which puts nearly every national monument designated since 1996 in jeopardy. It specifically requests the DOI to review the designations of 28 national monuments and determine if these designations were too large in size, let's say, or too impactful on local communities and economies.
Here's the good news. You get to submit your comments about this executive order, and we'll give you the details about how you can do this.
Now, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Brenda with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage collection and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Thank you for helping to keep Summit County clean and green. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Okay.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, during the first half of the show today, Carl Pope is joining us. He's a veteran leader in the environmental movement and the former executive director and chairman of the Sierra Club. He's now the principal advisor at Inside Street Strategies, focusing on the links between sustainability and economic development, and serves as a senior climate advisor to Bloomberg. Today, of course, he joins us to discuss his new book, co-authored with Bloomberg, Climate of Hope, How Cities, Businesses, and Citizens Can Save the Planet. Carl, welcome to the show.
Terrific to join you guys.
So let's start with this. Tell us a little bit about the history of your relationship with Michael Bloomberg and when the two of you hatched this plan to create a book together.
Well, we had been working with Bloomberg Philanthropies when I was still at the Sierra Club, and we began the effort to retire America's 500 outmoded and dirty coal-fired power plants and replace them with cleaner and cheaper wind, solar, and natural gas. And as we did that and we got ready for the Paris Climate Summit, we realized that leadership, not just in the United States, but around the world, wasn't coming from the top down anymore. We realized that leadership was coming from the bottom up. It was cities in places like Brazil and China and Europe that were pushing national governments to be more ambitious when they got to Paris. It was business coalitions and the insurance industry that was telling the G7, the major industrial countries, that they should stop subsidizing fossil fuels, and that it was citizen action in places like India and Indonesia that was creating a demand for clean energy rather than going down the pathway of following dirty fossil fuels as Europe and the West had done. So we realized that we were winning the war on climate, but we weren't winning it in a way that people could easily recognize, because we'd all been told there's going to be a big sacrifice. There's going to be a big global treaty, and the big global treaty is going to decide how much pain each country has to experience. What we saw happening was not people experiencing pain, but people signing up for opportunity, making their lives cleaner, making their economy stronger, making their nations more secure by solving climate problems from the bottom up. And we thought it was worth a book.
And did the results of the most recent presidential election speed up or change your plans for the book?
Influence you in some way?
Expedite? Yeah.
Well, the book was on the same schedule. We had the publication date. We did change the title. We thought it was important to emphasize hope. Hope was not in the original title. And we, of course, had to modify a few things to reflect the fact that Mr. Trump was now our president, and that, you know, what was previously a situation in which we had a president who wanted action and a Congress that obstructed him, we now had a president and a Congress that collectively want to slow the tide. But as King Canute pointed out to his courtiers back in pre-medieval England, you can wave your hand at the tide, but the tide doesn't stop. And it's an interesting fact that on the clean energy front, for example, America's biggest public utility, the Southern Company, the CEO, Mr. Fanning, likes to say you can't stop renewable energy any more than you can stop a wave from hitting the beach. You guys live right there in Salt Lake City, and you know what was a pretty friendly state for Donald Trump. But Salt Lake City has decided that it can get all of its electricity from clean renewables. So we're seeing this tide sweep on. Trump is elected. Trump is going to try to slow things down. Trump is very dangerous on a whole host of fronts, primarily to your public health, because that's a place where he is doing a lot of damage to EPA. But when it comes to climate progress, I don't think Donald Trump is going to have nearly as much of an impact as people think.
Right. And like you've highlighted, you say Salt Lake City sees the reality and opportunities in other cities like New York City, Miami, L.A., Seattle, Chicago. They all are kind of recognize what's happening here, what the consequences are of not acting to reduce reliance on fossil fuels. And so that's where you come, within this country, those are the cities, but you say there are cities around the world who also embrace the same perspective.
And it's not just large cities in this country. The first city in the United States to decide to go 100% renewable was Georgetown, Texas. And the mayor of Georgetown, Texas was very clear. He said, we have not become environmental extremists. We just want to save money. In fact, my favorite story about the economics of clean energy is that the Museum of the Coal Industry in eastern Kentucky announced last month that it was changing its energy source from coal to solar because it wanted to save money, and that was the smart thing to do.
Wow, they put a public news press release out on that?
A public press release out that, and they told people they were saving $6,000 to $10,000 a year by going from coal to solar.
Wow.
And so, that's in Kentucky, which is actually a reasonably cloudy place.
Yes. And if just to kind of pat ourselves out here on the back, Park City is also pledged to become fossil fuel free, so to speak, carbon zero by 2022 for its municipal infrastructure and 2032 for the town in its entirety. So, yes,
Park City.
Yes, and Summit County, too, has a very robust climate action plan. So there are, like you say, lots of small communities around the country that are getting on board with respect to doing something about their climate. Because we're in Park City, we're very much tied to the climate. Our economy is very much tied to the climate.
Yes, indeed it is.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, some of these reasons for optimism. What are some of the really exciting, you know, trends or patterns that you're seeing out there?
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example that doesn't have to do with electricity. We're now at a place where all over the world, the government of India, for example, has announced that by 2030, every vehicle sold in India will be powered by electricity. They will no longer allow the sale of combustion engines in India after 2030. The Chinese government has canceled more coal-fired power plants than the United States had. We are seeing a tremendous upsurge of interest in mass transit. The city of Vienna, which has the largest percentage of transit reliance of any city in the world, right now 60% of every trip taken in Vienna that involves a vehicle is taken on public transit, and Vienna is planning to raise that number to 80%, setting a new benchmark for cities getting off of dependent on the single-passenger automobile. Tesla is worth more than General Motors on the stock market, and that's clearly a vote by the market in the future of the electric vehicle. It's not based on Tesla's current sales, which, of course, are a fraction of General Motors. It's based on the market looking and saying the future belongs to clean energy.
Well, here's another one. I just learned yesterday through a press release from the Department of Interior, the Navajo Generating Station, this is a huge coal-fired power plant down in the southwestern portion. Well, let me get this right. The southeastern portion of Utah. It's a 2,100 megawatt sized plant. That's about three times the size of an average coal-fired power plant, so it's huge. It is making plans to retire somewhere in 2019, within the next 2 years. So there is,
and that was about 10 years earlier than it had been planned to be retired.
There you go. Okay. So these are encouraging signs, like you say, from municipal standpoint, from the business standpoint. This is a business decision at the end of the day that the Navajo Nation is making with respect to this generating station.
And globally, you have to ask the question, okay, we have anecdotes, but how is it adding up globally? Well, globally, we were told that, you know, we really needed to have climate emissions globally peak by 2025. They actually, the last 3 years, we've had no growth globally in climate emissions, in spite of the fact that the world economy has continued to grow. So we may already have reached peak emissions, and we may be now looking forward to a period where sometime in the next 5 years, those emissions are going to start coming down globally.
Wow. And these are the kinds of things that it's so exciting to hear. We don't hear them as frequently on the news. These are not the things that get highlighted on
or on this show.
On shows like this Green Earth.
Yeah.
So. So you also mention in the book that the U.S. is on track to meet the goals from the Paris Accord, you know, with or without support from the federal government. Is this true? And can you talk us through how this is working?
Sure. Well, what's happened is that we've already, by the end of 2015, we'd done 11% of the 25% cut that is our Paris pledge. And we've done that, obviously, well before 2025. We are looking forward, and cities are moving very rapidly, as we've discussed, but also the private sector is moving. I believe that the most surprising, probably big company in the United States that's embraced the renewables revolution is Anheuser-Busch. I mean, it's a beer company. This is not some kind of software company. This is not some West Coast outlier. This is America's biggest beer brewer, and they're going to go 100% renewable. The biggest deal for electric car purchases ever set up was set up by 30 American cities, which collectively have agreed to spend $10 billion buying 114,000 electric vehicles. So we're seeing tremendous progress at every level in the United States, except the federal government. And all of the projections that we've been able to do suggest that with continued leadership from cities, and let me give you an example of why a city might lead. Most Americans don't realize it, but if you have a leaking natural gas main outside your house, leaking methane into the sky, creating a health risk, a safety hazard, and polluting the climate, you still pay for the gas that you don't use. You pay for that leaked gas.
Right.
So the gas company really has very little incentive to fix that leak. Once people become aware of that, they start saying, wait a minute, I want to pay for the gas I use. That's fair. I don't want to pay for gas that the gas company lets leak, which I have no control over. So even though the Trump administration is very reluctant to clean up methane from leaking natural gas fields, I think we're going to see that the landowners and the communities around those fields are going to insist at the local and state level that the job get done.
If you are just joining us, we're speaking with Carl Pope. He's the co-author, along with Michael Bloomberg, of the new book, Climate of Hope: How Cities, Businesses, and Citizens Can Save the Planet. So, Carl, let's talk a little bit about what people can do in their day-to-day lives that relates to this. How can people help to move these efforts along?
Well, our important message to people is your day-to-day life isn't just something you live in isolation. You live in a neighborhood. You probably work in some kind of company. You have kids in a school. And all of those institutions need to be asked the question, how can we make money, do our job better, and do something good for the climate? For example, if you have a kid in a school district and that school district hasn't stopped the leaks in its buildings, that's money you're wasting. A leaky school building is not as good for learning, and the money that's wasted could be used to pay teachers. So your school district ought to retrofit its building.
Right.
If you're a student and you're thinking about, what can I do, how can I make an impact, you have real power when you go to a job interview. If you get a job interview and you ask the company you're going to, what's your sustainability policy? What are you doing to make sure that you catch the clean energy revolution? I want to be part of the future, not part of the past. That's actually going to send a very powerful message to your potential employer that, hey, the people I want to hire care about my sustainability policy. My own personal guess is that's why Anheuser-Busch decided to go 100% renewable, was to be able to say to people who wanted to come work there, we're leaders, not followers.
So, well, you and Michael Bloomberg are both citizens, right? And you have different, it says in the intro, you had different perspectives and different viewpoints going into writing this book. Talk a little bit about some of those differences you might have had.
Well, Mike is more optimistic about the potential economics of nuclear power than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I am more skeptical of international trade agreements than he is.
Hmm.
But we both agree, for example, if you look at trade agreements, we both agree that they need to be written in a way that makes sure that they reward countries that take positive steps towards climate and don't encourage, say, the steel industry to move to places where steel is produced in very dirty ways.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some different perspectives, but we all agree that in each one of these areas of human life, we can do things better. And if we do things better, we will not only clean up the climate, we will also make ourselves more prosperous, healthier, and more secure. So we see this as a huge, we see innovation and change as huge forces that we need to pursue for a variety of reasons. And by the way, if we do pursue them, we will stabilize the climate. That's why we wrote the book.
Hmm.
So I'm curious if you've always had this optimistic or positive view on the future of, you know, climate and the environmental state of the world, I guess. Or is this something that's more recent for you as you've been seeing some of the changes that have taken place?
Well, I'm temperamentally an optimistic person, but I always thought that it was actually going to be expensive to solve the climate problem and that we were going to have to sacrifice some degree of today's economic progress to protect tomorrow. That's not true anymore. Even up through Copenhagen, it wasn't entirely clear that clean energy would be cheaper than dirty energy, that electric cars would be cheaper than internal combustion vehicles. Those things weren't clear as recently as 2009, and they are clear now. So the optimism in terms of being able to say to people, let's stop talking about sacrifice and let's start talking about opportunity. That's new.
Carl, we got a few more minutes. I can't let you go without talking about the arc of your career, your involvement in the environmental field. You're executive director of the Sierra Club, among other things. But I assume that you probably, perhaps decades ago, started as a volunteer with the Sierra Club or so.
Well, I actually, my environmental career was triggered when I spent 2 years in India in the Peace Corps after college. Hmm. And I came back and it was Earth Day 1970. And I went to work for environmental organizations, mainly about clean air. I mean, clean air was the first issue I worked on.
Right.
And then I spent many years with the Sierra Club. But things really began to change in 2005 when the Sierra Club's grassroots leadership decided that climate change was going to be the organization's number one priority. And that's when I found myself swept into this global transformation where no longer are we trying to clean up yesterday's economy, we're trying to build tomorrow's.
And are you encouraged, I guess, that, you know, what you see, I say, since 2005?
I'm tremendously encouraged. I mean, I remember in 2006, I was just beginning to work on the climate side of things full time. And I started noticing that when I went to speak, I went to Cleveland and I gave a speech, and I'd been in Cleveland before and I knew who my audience was. And suddenly my audience was different. There were a bunch of businessmen in suits in the audience. And I started talking to them and I realized they were there because they sensed that this was the economic future. And I realized that something had changed.
Go ahead now.
Well, with that, we have just a couple of minutes left.
Yeah.
Where can people learn more about the book, learn more about the work that you and Michael Bloomberg are doing, and get involved?
Well, people should go to wherever they usually like to buy books. I mean, this is available, I think, in most bookstores. It's available online as well. And I really would encourage people to take a look at it. And at least if you go to the bookstore, and if you're working in agriculture, look at the chapter on food. If you're working in transportation, look at the chapter on getting around. If you're working in healthcare, we've got a chapter on the clean energy revolution and what some of its pollution benefits will be. Because we try to write the book around the way we live our lives so that anybody could pick it up and find a hook, a way, a pathway that they could do what they're doing now better and also help the climate.
Right, and that's a good point, because no matter what your livelihood is, what your career is, it has an influence directly or indirectly on the environment and on the environment, on our climate too. It's all linked like that. All right, Carl Pope, again, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. Again, the book is titled Climate of Hope: How Cities, Businesses, and Citizens Can Save the Planet. It's by Michael Bloomberg and Carl Pope. And Carl, I'll give you the last word. Any other plugs you want to make?
Well, I just want to say that the other thing I want to emphasize is that once we stop talking about sacrifice and start talking about opportunity, people who might think this is a partisan issue ought to take another look at that question.
Yeah.
I don't really think there's anything partisan about saving money. I mean, if wind and solar are now providing the cheapest electricity the world has ever known, we shouldn't be having an argument about whether we should be picking winners or losers. Wind and solar are the winners. The market has made that decision, and everybody ought to take advantage of it. So we shouldn't be having this partisan conversation about saying, well, maybe climate isn't quite as bad as the scientists say. If you're going to make money, who cares? I mean, we're no longer talking about sending you a bill. We're talking about writing you a check, and we ought to make that check as big as possible.
Well, I think we
Fair
all
enough.
Like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Those are important words to remember right now, I think. Carl Pope, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters and sponsors, and when we come back, we're going to turn our attention to the executive order recently signed by the president, asking the Department of Interior to review dozens of national monuments. We're going to be talking to a representative from the Wilderness Society about that. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Carolyn from Recycle Utah. Don't dump that cooking oil in your trash or drain. When cooking oil ends up in the landfill or drain, it can be harmful to our water. Recycle Utah has a solution for you. Bring your used liquid cooking oils and fats to the recycling center, and it'll be used to make biodiesel. Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center. bringing water conservation ideas to you for over 25 years, and we support KPCW.
Wyndham Vacation Rentals is happy to continue our support for KPCW and the Park City community. Wyndham Vacation Rentals has been in business for over 30 years in nightly vacation rentals and property management with a range of services for our owners and guests. 649-6606 or online at wvrparkcity.com.
Welcome back to The Screen Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, in the second half of the show today, we're going to talk about the president's recent executive order, which asks for a thorough review of the national monuments that have been designated since 1996. Here to fill us in on that, give us the details, and tell us what to expect is Dan Hardinger, the National Monuments Campaign Manager from the Wilderness Society. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with this. When this executive order was first being talked about and then signed, is this something that you had anticipated and been preparing for? Or did it take the Wilderness Society kind of by surprise?
You know, I think it's something, given the Utah delegation's outspoken advocacy to the president on Bears Ears in particular, that we certainly weren't surprised by. But it's important not to lose sight of the fact that this is very much unprecedented. No president has ever acted to revoke a national monument. So the rhetoric around the executive order in some ways historically is surprising. But given this administration's view of industry on public lands and Senators Lee and Hatch's advocacy to the president, it wasn't too surprising, unfortunately.
But it seems like, to me at least, the scope of this review is much larger than I thought. This is nearly every national monument that had been designated since 1996, I believe, that is greater than 100,000 acres in size, is quote unquote up for review. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I think it's also important to notice that it's not just those 27 monuments that are greater than 100,000 acres in size and are specifically mentioned, but potentially over 50, because there is some language in the executive order and in the press release the Department of the Interior put out on Friday that also says other monuments that the secretary deems had insufficient local input could also be at risk. So well, there are, you know, the 27 monuments that they specify alone is a pretty huge amount of protections to look at. It could potentially be even broader than that, depending on the secretary's prerogative.
And just to you know, draw some out, I mean, obviously it includes Bears Ears in Utah. The other one in Utah is Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. But listen to some of these other names of monuments, you know, under review: Berryessa Snow Mountain, Cascade Siskiyou, Craters of the Mountain, Giant Sequoia, Mojave Trail, San Gabriel Mountains National Monument, Sonoran Desert National Monument, and then there's marine national monuments, the Pacific Remote Islands, and of course, Nell and mine's favorite, Papahana Umakuakea. I practiced all morning on that. That's a huge national monument, perhaps one of the largest ones off the coast of Hawaii. They are, I'll say it, they're all at risk. You know, let's talk what this, what does this review entail?
That's a good question. And I think it's absolutely fair to say these are all at risk. So as of right now, what we do know is that the executive order directs the Department of the Interior to review these monuments and come back with an interim recommendation for what to do with Bears Ears National Monument 45 days after the review, or after the executive order was signed, which will be on June 10th. And then after 120 days following the executive order signing, they're supposed to come back with a final report with recommendations for potential changes to all the monuments under the review. Last Friday, Interior announced that they are going to be opening a public comment period on these monuments with a 15 days of comments starting on May 12th for specific to Bears Ears, and another 60 days starting on May 12th for all the other monuments. So what we do know is that there will be opportunity for public comment, and we are going to be working to make sure the public is as aware of that as possible, which is why I really appreciate you having me on the program. And then, you know, we do know there are some factors they're supposed to be looking at that the executive order directs them to look at, you know, whether designated lands were appropriately classified and that they contain historic landmarks and objects of historic scientific interest. Mm-hmm. That one, you know, I frankly don't see how the review could find any other way. Anyone who's been to these monuments can tell you that the places they protect, the archaeological resources, the sandstone cliffs, the incredible slot canyons, are certainly objects of historic and scientific interest. It also is supposed to look at the multiple uses of the land. And, you know, I think what you certainly see in Utah is that despite a lot of myths about how national monuments, you know, apparently lock out the public, what you see is that they remain open for a wide variety of uses, everything from grazing to hunting and fishing to, off-road vehicle use on designated roads and trails to, gathering herbs and ceremonial objects. I mean, so there are a number of things they're supposed to be looking at in the review, but we're not really sure what is ultimately going to make up the secretary's mind. That part is pretty unclear.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Secretary Zinke. When he was first coming into his position, we kept hearing about how he was relatively friendly to public lands. He thought public lands were really important, even if he did sort of see a different or support a different type of use, maybe more extractive. But where does he stand on this now? Is there any idea of, how he's leaning?
Publicly, he's sticking to a line that essentially he's saying there is no determined outcome of this review. Now, for those of us who watched the press conference when the president signed this executive order, it seems that Senator Hatch and President Trump seem to think the opposite, that there is a predetermined outcome of this review, particularly when it comes to Bears Ears. But taking him at his word, that's what he's saying. The other thing that he has said repeatedly, not only as the secretary, but also during the nomination process, is that he views himself as a Teddy Roosevelt Republican, someone who has claimed Teddy Roosevelt is his icon, is his, inspiration for his work. And it's important to keep in mind that Roosevelt was the one who signed the Antiquities Act into law in the first place. He used it to designate 18 monuments, including the Grand Canyon. One of the things that stood out to me is that when Secretary Zinke was speaking during the press conference on the executive order, he seemed to mischaracterize the history of the Antiquities Act, particularly when it came to Roosevelt's uses. He referenced Roosevelt's protection of Devil's Tower and the size of that at 1,200 acres, in implying that recent presidents have, he claimed abused the act for much larger designations. What, I think he either ignored or glossed over is that Roosevelt also used it for, Mount Olympus National Monument, which is now Olympic National Park at over 600,000 acres, as well as for the Grand Canyon, which at the time was over 800,000 acres. So, if Roosevelt had stuck to the same criteria that Interior is recommending for, review monuments over 100,000 acres, many of the places, Americans love and cherish today wouldn't be around.
Right.
Proclaimed uproar over the Antiquities Act is nothing new.
Sure.
In 1896, the largest newspaper in Arizona referred to the protection of the Grand Canyon as a fiendish and diabolical scheme to undermine the fate of Arizona. So, you know, if you look at a lot of the rhetoric around public lands protections, unfortunately, for some, it hasn't changed in 120 years.
Right. What's interesting about the Antiquities Act is that, like you're saying, Dan, that the president, it gives the president the latitude to select lands and declare them as national monuments, and it doesn't require public review. And I think that's one of the things here that's kind of highlighted, right? Let me give you a quote that Secretary Zinke says. He says, "Being a good steward is being a good neighbor and listening to the American people who we represent. Today's action, initiating a formal public comment process, finally gives a voice to local communities and states when it comes to the Antiquities Act monument designations." So here's it, like now I said in the intro, here's our chance for the public to submit our comments about what we think about this review. And so let's real quick, and we'll go back to, we have a couple other questions, but where can people go to submit their comments?
So there's a few places. The Wilderness Society will soon be posting opportunities for the public to submit comments directly via our website, which we will ensure get to the Department of the Interior. The other place is the Department of the Interior is going to be posting the public comment on regulations.gov. That link is not live yet. It's going to be going live on Friday, May 12th. But, you know, if you follow the Wilderness Society or other groups that are working on public lands issues, you know, Sierra Club or National Parks Conservation Association and many others, you will have many outlets that will be showing you how to submit comments. You can also mail them directly to the Department of the Interior at 1849 C Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. And we're hearing there may be a couple of other ways via email and other routes to submit comments. That's not final yet. We're still trying to get final word on that from the Department of the Interior, but there will certainly be an online portal. People can mail them in, but they can also go through our website at wilderness.org to submit comments.
All right, we'll post that on our website, too.
Perfect. So you mentioned that no president before has ever acted to revoke a national monument. So in looking at this, is that legal? Is there some legal challenge to that? Or is this process going to be purely based on, you know, the public feedback or, I don't know, other current political opinions?
Right.
So I'll answer the legal part first. Many legal scholars do not believe the president has that authority. This dates back to 1938. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was looking at potentially rescinding Castle Pinckney National Monument. His attorney general studied the issue and determined that the president does not have the authority to revoke a national monument. So that 1938 attorney general opinion says he does not have the authority. Many legal scholars who are well-practiced in public lands law concur with that opinion. And in 1976, when Congress passed the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, there is language in that bill that seems to further reserve to Congress the authority to revoke or modify a national monument. So there's a couple of key legal points that would indicate the president doesn't have this authority. That being said, it's never been tested. No president has ever attempted to do so. Now, Congress has done that. It's been very rare. It's only happened a little over 10 times, which I think speaks to how unpopular removing protections for, you know, our historic and cultural treasures would be. But we certainly don't think it would be legal. I know tribal nations share that opinion, and so if the president attempted to revoke a protection for or substantially diminish protections for national monuments via executive order, he would almost certainly have legal suits on his hands.
All right. So I think a lot of this has to do, let's say, for at least one component is the size. I think you hear lots of complaints from Congressman Bishop and Chaffetz talking about the size. There's kind of a it's not following the written letter of the Antiquities Act that talk again about the smallest area compatible with proper care and management of the objects to be protected. So for Bears Ears, for example, it's 1.3 or so million acres in size. Let's say they come back and say, you know what, we're going to reduce it. We're not going to rescind it, but we're going to reduce it to 900,000 acres. That still requires that would trigger a lot of legal response. Is that true?
That's correct. The legal opinion that the president doesn't have the authority to revoke also extends to substantial diminishments. The authority to manage a monument and the smallest area compatible is about the protection of those objects. So if you're looking at a boundary modification that would remove protections for key objects, you know, in the case of Bears Ears, we're talking about archaeological resources and cultural and sacred sites. You know, if you removed, you know, a few hundred thousand acres from the monument and suddenly left those sites unprotected, in essence, you're revoking portions of the proclamation in a way. So that would be particularly problematic and would result in suits. And I do think it's important on the boundary question to point out that this is already a substantially reduced and compromised boundary. The Intertribal Coalition's proposal was seeking protection of a 1.9 million acre area, and that was well documented and justified with all of the resources in the area. I mean, this portion of Utah is one of the most archaeologically and culturally rich landscapes, arguably, in the entire world. So, but as you pointed out, the designation does protect 1.35 million acres, which is only very slightly larger than the boundaries included in the bill that Congressman Bishop and Congressman Chaffetz introduced, the Utah Public Lands Initiative. Their boundaries for the area, I mean, frankly, if you squint at the two maps side by side, they look nearly identical.
Right. Okay.
So I know you've only got a couple more minutes, and we wanted to take a minute to talk about a letter that you and the Wilderness Society, along with more than 450 other organizations, sent to the president. So tell us a little bit about who signed on to this letter and what it said.
Yeah. So this letter was in response to the executive order, expressing our deep concern with, you know, many of the implications made both in the executive order and the signing, essentially implying that, you know, our protections for our history, our culture, and our natural treasures were negotiable and under review that could result in them being revoked. And one of the things that makes our country so great is our parks and monuments. It's a system that's unrivaled nearly anywhere in the world. And the way we celebrate and protect our shared history and culture and natural wonders is something that so many different people can relate to, and that's what's so wonderful about the Antiquities Act and National Monuments is that it brings so many different people together, people who care about historic preservation and conservation, but also outdoor recreation groups and, you know, climbers and businesses that benefit from monuments. So the groups who signed our letter are a really eclectic mix of groups. It's everyone from the NAACP, to the Wilderness Society, to Patagonia and outdoor retailers and businesses, to local chambers of commerce and sportsmen's groups. You know, collectively, the groups signed onto the letter represent millions of Americans from all walks of life, nearly every state, both at the local, you know, state and national level. And I think that really shows just how important and valued our parks and monuments are.
And is there data on, you know, how many Americans want to see, you know, these protections upheld or want to see more public land protected or things along those lines? I know you guys state in the letter that Americans want more protected public lands and waters, not less. How do we know that?
So there's a few ways. And frankly, I think it's hard to find a poll that doesn't show a substantial majority of Americans want public lands and waters protected. But if you look at the 2017 Colorado College Conservation in the West poll, this is a poll they do every year of voters in Western states. And what that found was that 80% of Western voters support keeping existing national monuments in place. And then, you know, if you look, there was a 2014 poll that was commissioned by the Center for American Progress that found 90% of Americans support protecting, you know, some of our public lands and waters permanently as wildlife refuges, parks, and monuments. And there's numerous other polls that show this, but, you know, really what you're looking at is, you know, not just a majority, but, you know, a nearly unanimous support for protections of our parks and monuments.
Fantastic. Well, I think we need to let you go and move on to your next meeting today.
That's Dan Hardinger. He's the National Monuments Campaign Manager with the Wilderness Society. And thanks so much. Real quick, the public comment period starts this Friday, May 12th. You can go to, among other things, you can go to the Wilderness Society and find out how to submit your comments on this to this executive order reviewing our national monuments around the country. We'll provide you some additional details at the end of the show on our website, too. Dan, again, thanks so much for chatting with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, we've got a couple of news items to run through. Right now, say yes.
That's right. We've got something to talk about.
All right. We better. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
If you have a family history of diabetes, macular degeneration, glaucoma, or developing cataracts, having an annual eye exam is critical. This is Dr. Colleen Chuback with the Moran Eye Center at University of Utah Health. Early diagnosis and treatment can greatly reduce or prevent harm to your vision before damage occurs. Schedule your eye exam at the Redstone Health Center at 658-9200. University of Utah Health is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And we got about 5 minutes to cover a couple of news items. One, which came across our desk.
That's right.
A few days ago. We track this every year. We've been doing it for 15 years now?
Since you were in high school?
Since I was a wee babe. We track the Mauna Loa's observatory's recording of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, which is really much, pretty much what everyone follows to see how we're doing with respect to controlling our consumption, burning of fossil fuels, since that's what produces so much carbon dioxide. Back in, let's say, pre-World War II, pre-industrial, post-World War II, we were at around 190, 200, 210 parts per million. Mm-hmm. Well, this past, just a couple weeks ago, they got the new numbers out, and we hit 410 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Yes, exactly.
If I could whistle well, I would I would whistle at that. That's a big jump. I mean, you think not too long ago we were talking about we got to keep it at 350.
Well, that's 350.org's whole premise.
Exactly. That's where the name comes
from.
Let's
try not to give up 350.
And then we broke 400, and man, now we're just flying
right past it. We broke 400 in 2013 now. Remember that show?
I sure do.
400, that was a depressing
show. We both wore black.
Not much. Okay, I'm wearing black. And now we're at 410 in just roughly 3-4 years later. So we're moving incrementally up. Like, it used to be like one part per million a year.
Yeah.
Now it seems to be 2 parts per million a year. And soon it'll be 3 parts per million. It's not a linear progression. So, okay.
Okay, I was going to say, but in the spirit of today's show, we started off with the book Climate of Hope, where we learned that we may have reached peak emissions. They've remained flat globally for the past couple of years. Now, not that that doesn't mean that we're still releasing carbon and those numbers could keep going up, but it means that they'll, at least for the time being, go up more slowly. The trend is kind of heading in the right direction. So that's exciting news.
It's heading in the right direction. Yeah, as far as our fossil fuel consumption goes, yes. We're trying to do our best to burn less coal.
That's right.
Maybe less natural gas and, of course, oil. So maybe this 410 parts per million will first level off, right? And that's what we got to hope for, a leveling first. Mm-hmm. But right now, it's not happening. There's a lot of carbon dioxide that's kind of baked into the cake here, right? We talk about that it could take years for our actions today to finally show up with respect to levels of carbon dioxide and methane, too, because those are being tracked, too, and those are increasing. So, yes, there's a lot of hope. And there's a lot of good things going on, but like Carl Pope says, in cities around the country and the world. But this is the benchmark number we need to follow, and it's at 410, so we still have a lot of work to do. All right, so that's a little news item there. Do you have anything else now? 2 minutes? 3 minutes?
No news. There's always some fun events coming up at Swanner. It's the last week of the Small Wonders insect exhibit. So come stop by and see that if you haven't before it gets removed. It's open through this weekend. It's also a really great time of year to get outside and learn a little bit about what's going on around us. And we host nature walks every Saturday morning at 8:30 a.m. That are guided by a naturalist who can kind of talk to you about what you're seeing outside right now.
Perfect. All right. And again, as a reminder, with respect to this executive order on national monuments that was signed last week, it's Executive Order 13792. The review period, the comment period, starts this Friday, May 12th. Among other things, you can simply go to regulations.gov and either enter in the search bar EO 13792 or a little longer, DOI 2017-0002, and you will come to the page where you can submit your comments and a subject line. Your subject line matters on this. Make sure that you condense your thoughts in the subject line, because they may not have time to read the millions of comments they're going to, so they may just look at the subject line. That's important. And while you're at it, forward your comments to Senators Hatch and Lee and Congressman Bishop and Chaffetz. Take a couple extra minutes and forward your comments to them, too. Let them know what you think about this review, this potential review, and all these national monuments that are at risk. We talked about, 28 of them or so. At least, and maybe more.
And Bears Ears here in Utah is kind
Bears
of
Ears
first to
and
be
Grand
reviewed.
Staircase
so
Escalante. That's right. There's only a 15-day period for that, starting May 12th. All right. We got our last couple of underwriters, and we got to wrap up. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's time to wrap up. We'd like to thank the underwriters of This Green Earth. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
that's right, Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and of course, listeners like you.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City.